This past week, President Trump made good on another campaign promise as he announced that the United States is pulling out of the nuclear agreement with Iran. While the U.S. has headed for the exit, the other countries who sign on to this plan are remaining committed to, at least for the here and now. With us now to review the flaws which exist in this agreement, the U.N.'s role in its creation, and why it was important for the U.S. to pull out, is award-winning journalist who has spent decades reporting from the Middle East and other locations, as well as the U.N. He's currently a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum and author of the book, What to Do About the U.N., Claudia Rosette. Thanks for being here today, Claudia.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. Thank you.
IWF.org. We read Claudia's work regarding her connection with the Independent Women's Forum and, again, her book, What to Do About the U.N. Well, just for the start with the nuclear agreement with Iran, Claudia, the impression, the pitch of it is, well, it's a rock-solid agreement which Iran has been adhering to. True or false?
False. It was built on quicksand. I mean, this was a terrible deal. And as far as Iran has been technically adhering to some of it, not even all of it, it's a deal that even if Iran adhered to it, allowed Iran to continue honing, improving its nuclear program, its nuclear capabilities. It, in fact, promised transfer of nuclear technology to Iran from countries with, you know, highly advanced abilities, including the United States and the European Union. We're supposed to be helping them out, along with giving them far freer access to the world trading system, to sell things, buy things, and so on, which they have used in the past as cover for procurement for their nuclear and missile programs, among other things. And in sum, it was a deal that did not even begin to address the basic problem, which is the Iranian regime itself, the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism. In fact, it ensured far more resources for this regime and gave it a pass on carrying on with nuclear development. So good riddance to this deal.
I mentioned, too, that there are other countries who signed on to this along with the U.S. The U.S. did not do it via Congress and normal treaty procedure. They went straight to the U.N., doing an run completely around Congress. Did the other countries do that similar path, or did they go through all their in-house apparatus and agree to it internally?
Well, some of these countries, you have to look at what the in-house apparatus would be in any event. For instance, what were the countries that signed on? There were the group that negotiated with Iran was the five members of the UN Security Council, plus Germany, with the European Union sort of coordinating some of this. And then Russia, and that includes Russia and China. So five members of the Security Council, Russia, China, the U.S., Britain, and France. So let's take China. What are the sort of procedures there? China's a dictatorship that never involved some sort of popular assent to this thing. Russia's a dictatorship. And the deal, in order to be approved by all of them, had to be something that was acceptable to not only to Iran, which was the basic problem, but to Russia and China, which have a lot of interests at this stage hostile to the United States. So you had a setup where a lot of it was kind of phony baloney anyway. You know, Russia approves. That's not necessarily a sign that this is going to stop Iran's nuclear development. Russia has been selling nuclear technology to Iran since at least the 1990s for the Bushehr reactor. And China has been one of the prime conduits and hubs for Iran's illicit procurement, you know, including one Chinese businessman who's had a $5 million price on his head, wanted in the United States since about 2014 for his help to the Iranians in their missile and nuclear procurement programs. So, again, it sounds, beware of the labels here, you know, the deal unanimously approved by the Security Council. And as you say, President Obama used the UN as a sort of substitute for Senate ratification of treaties. This was never ratified by the Senate. Actually, it was never signed by anybody. This wasn't a signed deal. It was a consensus agreement among these countries, which Obama then rushed to the UN Security Council. They approved it, and then he gave it to Congress to sort of fruitlessly debate. for the summer of 2015. It was a travesty on basically every level.
In addition to the fact that the country of Iran made out like a bandit with all the money they received.
Yeah, they got access to, there were sort of several slices to what they received. They got access to the money that they had earned by selling oil under a sort of quota system under U.S. and U.N. sanctions, and where that money had been kept frozen in accounts outside of, that Iran could not access. That was released to them. So that was money that came from their oil sales, but they'd been walled off from it. Suddenly, this great flood of money comes in from that. And then, of course, they've been able to continue earning money going forward. And we're talking about billions upon billions of dollars because they're a major oil-producing country. And then, of course, there was the sort of free cherry on top that was not officially part of the deal, but sure looked like a ransom payment for the return of U.S. hostages after, as the deal went into effect. And that was $1.7 billion in shipped secretly in cash by the Obama administration as the deal went into effect, which was particularly egregious because that wasn't even money unfrozen from Iran's oil revenues. $1.3 billion of that secret cash shipment came from American tax dollars. In other words, if you're a taxpayer, from your wallet.
If your tax dollars at work, once again, we're talking with Claudia Rosette, who is a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, veteran journalist of the Middle East and elsewhere, author of the book What to Do About the UN, IWF.org, is a website for the Independent Women's Forum, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. And speaking of the UN, as we move forward with the Trump administration, Nikki Haley is the UN ambassador. Is that going to be an avenue of what happens next as far as U.S. and Iran in any way, shape, or form?
The yes and no. Yes and no is the answer. It depends what now happens. The European countries are saying they want to stick with the deal, and even though the U.S. has pulled out, it's very unclear exactly how that's going to play out. They're making money on business dealings with Iran. But with America now saying with President Trump reimposing U.S. sanctions in this sort of phased set of steps over the next 6 months, it's going to become a problem for them because some of their companies, if they continue doing business with Iran or if they sign new contracts, will be subject to U.S. sanctions. So there's now a considerable deterrent to carrying forward with that. And since this whole deal is enshrined at the UN, and it's unlikely that, say, Russia and China would agree to scrapping the resolution, it's really not clear exactly how that plays out. And what my best guess right now is that it will simply become irrelevant, and which would be a good thing. And to that end, having Nikki Haley as our ambassador to the UN is a very good thing. She's been just doing a terrific job at dealing with the great, you know, if you want a swamp, dealing with that, or a quicksand, or whatever metaphor you want to pick. She's been terrific at dealing with the UN, and I expect she would carry on in that way.
Some would say the D.C. is the swamp, the UN is the toxic waste dump.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, D.C., there's sort of a chance of dealing with fixing some things because we have elections, we have some sort of accountability there. The U.N. really doesn't have any. You know, the U.S. can try. And what we can mainly do there is, to some extent, thwart the worst initiatives. We have a veto at the Security Council, so we can block things from going through. We have a voice in the General Assembly, but only one vote out of 193 member states. However, General Assembly resolutions are non-binding. But here you get into sort of this ineffable realm where UN resolutions don't necessarily do anything anyway. I mean, the UN resolutions were calling for an end to both the North Korean and Iranian rogue nuclear programs, since 2006. And obviously with no effect. So
yes.
It's kind of a world of strange and shifting fictions there anyway.
When you say happy anniversary to your resolution, you have to realize something's not working here.
Yeah, as they stacked up over the years. You know, look at North Korea, where every time North Korea would test a nuclear bomb, they call it a device, but we're talking about a bomb, basically. Every time North Korea would test a nuclear bomb, the UN would pass the sanctions resolution, and sometimes they'd pass one anyway, you know, a missile testing. And this did not stop North Korea from carrying right on through the most recent test, number 6, last fall, of what was apparently a hydrogen bomb, far more powerful than the atomic bombs it had been testing, you know, began testing in 2006. So the stack of resolutions doesn't really protect you from anything.
She is a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, their website, IWF.org, and also author of the book, What to Do About the UN. Claudia Rosette, thanks so much for your insight today.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.